Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder, we Zoom on Tuesday afternoon. Something should happen Tuesday night. We'll be talking about it on Thursday. Of course, we begin our show every single day. It's our drumbeat. Maybe it's our music. It is the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman at the impeachment hearings of 2019. I remember listening to him going, wow, maybe I should have joined the State Department. I was so impressed. And I realized that's the sound of a patriot. That's the sound of someone who really...
He has been exceptional through this entire process.
All right, this is my guest who's weighing in. Absolutely, Phil. So we begin our show. It's my drumbeat. Philip, you will not hear his testimony, but my audience will. But they have been hearing it all the time because I want them to have his voice resonating in their ears when they go in to exercise the franchise in November of 2020. All right, everyone, now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. We normally just segue right into our first guest, but I have to take a sort of point of personal privilege.
Sure.
I have done so much commercial radio. I've been on public radio. You name a radio, I've been on it. I've been on radio stations the size of a peanut in the middle of a cornfield, and I've been on community radio stations, which is what I'm on now, from as big as 100,000 watts in Houston, Texas, to as tiny as 80. So I have covered the gamut. And right now, community radio is my life. I work, you know, 7 days a week, practically. I don't get paid a dime, but I have learned so much and met so many interesting people, and we get to share our radio show with people all over the country. So one of my board members said, Arnie, the father of community radio just died today at age 99, today being Tuesday. I did not know who he was. So I thought, well, at least if nothing else, I'll run to Wikipedia and grab a couple of sentences about him because in part, because of him, I am here. And I think we need to realize that. This is from Wikipedia, everyone. According to David Armstrong, in A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America, Milam's passion, that's the name of the gentleman in the past, for community radio and $1.1 million from the sale of a second station, KDNA St. Louis, to commercial broadcasters in 1973 led him to become a veritable Johnny Appleseed of community radio. He is credited with helping start 14 stations from the early 1960s to the late 1970s. He got his start in radio volunteering in 1958 at Lou Hill's KPFA in Berkeley, California. He used a $15,000 inheritance to buy a small FM transmitter in 1959 and spent the next 3 years seeking a broadcast license anywhere in the U.S. from the Federal Communications Commission, which eventually assigned him a frequency in Seattle. With the help of a volunteer engineer, he was able to get his antique Collins radio transmitter on the air in 1962, creating the station KRAB. His engineer later assisted him in launching other stations around the country, starting in 1968 with KBOO in Portland. Mr. Miller authored the book, Sex and Broadcasting, a handbook on starting a radio station for the community. He knew that sex sold. I love this man. Fast forward, Arnie Arneson, who's, you know, done every kind of radio, ends up landing on a little community radio station in Concord, New Hampshire. And now because of things like Pacifica Radio, we get to share our show with Maui and Michigan and North Carolina and New York and everywhere else, including Houston, Texas. So Mr. Millen, I'm great. glad you existed, and I'm glad that you put that inheritance to such great use. So I am a fanatic about economic justice, and I'm always looking to figure out how it is that we can sort of change policy to address what I think is the yawning inequality in America. And I saw an article that made me realize that perhaps this is the time, assuming Donald Trump does not win again, for us to begin to actually sort of re-examine the economy in America, the kind of inputs we need to make change. Joining us right now is the author of one of these articles, and there's a whole some series of reports. And the title was something that caught my eye. There can be no equality without a dramatic renewal of employment opportunity for all American workers. Joining me right now is Philip Moss. He is a professor of the Department of Economics and the co-director of Economics and Social Development of Regions Program at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He is an economist by training and teaches courses in local and regional development, public policy, organizational development, and research methods. As a researcher, he works primarily on the impacts of structural change in the economy, which actually, and within, firms the distribution of economic opportunity. So let me welcome Phil to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Let me just make one correction. Everything was true until about a year ago, and now I am Professor Emeritus.
Mazel tov. Congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you, and it gives me more time to do the work that I've been doing on economic opportunity and the racial divide.
Yeah. So, you know, I was going back to sort of my history. I'm 66 years old. I grew up, I was born in Brooklyn, raised on Long Island. My parents were two school teachers. A couple of things that I thought about as I was looking at your articles, and I was looking at, including the one, Employment and Earnings of African Americans 50 Years After Progress, And I thought about my early beginnings. So I had a younger brother. We were both honor students. Which one of us took stenography and typing?
Oh, you did.
Me. Which one went to private school and which one went to public school? Oh, me, public school. Which one was destined to go to law school so she could marry a lawyer? And which one was destined to go to law school so he could run a bank? My brother versus me. So as I'm looking at this sort of little bit of a history, my parents were massaging me based on gender, all right? And then I remember having a huge fight with my dad right after he had his big retirement dinner. And Philip, you will relate to this. My grandfather had worked for the AMP for 50 years and got a gold watch. 50 years, same job. My father worked at a job in New York City for over 41 years, same job. Oh my God, had a retirement dinner. And I remember saying to my dad, well, you know what's interesting, Dad? I've had about 41 jobs. I will never have a retirement dinner. I have now lost my health insurance three times. I have nothing socked away for retirement, and there is no retirement plan for me. And the level of instability and economic fragility for myself and my family is something you can't even comprehend. And he thought that there was something wrong with me, that I was not economically stable. So Phil, you're my defense to my dad, who's now dead. Because you talk about this no equality without a dramatic renewal of employment opportunity. Share with my audience what you really wrote about, because this is a story of an erosion, not just of the middle class, but an erosion of economic opportunity. And what I always think is so interesting is that my experience, unfortunately, has really been the experience of African Americans and Hispanics in America for a long time. This is not a new story for them. It is, however, a new story for me. And now we're all in a similar boat together, except I may start with a little more inheritance than them, but we also understand that our opportunities have been limited, and they've been limited intentionally.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Just a little context. The work that I've been doing for the last couple of years has been in conjunction with a fellow professor at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell, named William Lozonik, Bill Lozonik. And many of the ideas or framework within which we have been working were his development.
Okay.
I bring to this development a focus on race. And so in my discussion, I'm going to be talking about both those things. What you discussed,
exactly.
And what you discussed about the erosion of economic security is something that Bill has thought a great deal about. And he has tried to understand how the change in the way corporations are governed and the strategy that they have pursued, the migration of goals from reinvesting in the company and in workers to making profits that then get distributed to the shareholders,
right,
by and large, big, big fraction of the retained earnings, which are the profits of corporations, right, no longer stay in the corporations, but go to Wall Street. And so he's developed this framework and spent a long time trying to understand how it has created a number of difficulties, the biggest of which is, I think it is a very important driver of the just horrendous distribution of income, change in the distribution of income that's occurred. And when I teach my students on about the distribution of income, the thing that I want to hammer to them, first of all, is that it's extremely unequal. And I think probably most of your listeners are well aware of that, and the, how the fraction of income that's earned by the very very top is extremely high. And that the rest of the income distribution has stagnated a lot.
Right.
That is to say, the real, correcting for inflation, real wages for the broad middle have stagnated for 40 years. They haven't changed a great deal in close to 40 years. So that's one, and then if you look at the distribution of wealth, income is the flow from your work, you know,
right,
and the income that you get over time, the payments.
Right.
Wealth are the assets that you have. Like your house, your car, for a rarefied few, the stocks and bonds, real estate. And you can think of intangible things too, like your skills, you know, that is an asset that can generate a stream of income.
Exactly.
And that's what an asset is. It's something that can generate income for you.
Right.
And the distribution of wealth is much more unequal than the distribution of income. And the fraction of wealth that's held by the very top is much greater than the fraction of income. And the rest of the population has a very small fraction of wealth. So the top 10% owns as much wealth. I shouldn't speak without having my finger exactly on the numbers,
right,
but just the fraction of wealth that's held by the top 1%, the top 0.01%, is just enormous.
So like as we're looking at this,
like
one of the things, yeah, it's probably close to that for at least for the top 10. You know, it's just, so as we're looking at that, but it's not even just the fact that you have this division of wealth and all the wealth has seemed to sort of had the sucking sound and gone up to the top 5 to 1%. But you also have a flattening of the income, but then you also have, because there's this sort of connection to all the benefits of work, i.e. whether it's a pension that doesn't exist anymore, now it's a 401k, whether it's access to a healthcare plan, because that's how you get your healthcare, whether it's access to even additional education. When you look at all that, all those things have eroded as well. So it's not just the paycheck to pay the rent and to pay the mortgage and to pay the food. It's all those other things that, guess what now, Phil? I gotta now pay for out of that flattened paycheck. Screw you. You know what I mean? I've gotta pay the 20% copay. I gotta pay for this. I mean, people don't even get it. They're just looking at that paycheck. And I'm saying, no, sweetheart, what are you now paying for out of that paycheck that historically you may not have had to do in the past?
Well, that's a very, very important point. And it's one that we've tried to focus on, both to help understand how African Americans started to get their feet on some higher rungs of the ladder following the Civil Rights Act due to some fortuitous things of history, but also political movements and pressure, and how that eroded as a variety of changes occurred in the economy. And because they were the last in, they're the first out. So it hit them first and hardest. So what you mentioned, and let's just talk about that for a second, is this concept of a career with one company.
Yes, talk about a career with one company. I was so jealous of my dad. I said to my dad, the thing I am the most jealous of is your job security. The fact that you could say 10, 20, 30, 40 years, that is something I can't ever imagine.
Yeah, and in some occupations, it may not be exactly with one company, but it's still a career with security. For example, the building trades were pretty good jobs up until the 80s or so, when the non-union fraction of construction work and so on really started to grow. But that was where you might move between a variety of situations, but you had a career and you had a pension that was negotiated by the union, and managed by the union. But by and large, people worked for one employer. And along with that came a variety of things. Was increasing salary, increasing skills, typically of moving along an internal progression of mm-hmm. skill and jobs through seniority, and a pension, mm-hmm. access to health insurance. Mm-hmm. And this allowed in the post-World War II period, let me back up for a second. This was primarily a white man's game.
Yeah, no, trust me. I figured that out pretty quickly.
Women had much less access to any of that. You've said that very eloquently in describing your family background and so on and your career. And blacks had, African Americans had much less access to that. They may have worked for the kinds of companies that afforded those jobs to whites, but they tended to have very, very low job classifications. Right. But so, for example, there were certainly blacks in the auto industry, in the steel industry, in electronics, right. in various other things. But they tended to be low level laborers that didn't have access to the job ladders or the increases in pay and so on. And what you had in the 1960s was this confluence of a building civil rights movement, which everybody should understand was building since the 40s right. and through the 50s, but in a more passive sort of way of emphasizing equality as a concept, but not a direct action. The action of civil rights, the protests, the marches, the sit-ins, the boycotts, right. those sorts of things start to happen in the 60s. And we have the passage of the Civil Rights Act at a time when the economy is really growing strong, in part due to some circumstances of the business cycle, in part due to the emerging militarization of mm-hmm. of the economy, the Cold War, the space race, and then the Vietnam War. But there was a strong demand for labor and demand for blue collar labor, mm-hmm. And so blacks started, because of the pressure from the civil rights movement and the demand for labor, started to move into jobs that were more like the beginning of a career with one company. So they moved into unionized jobs in the blue collar manufacturing sector. And that continued through the late part of the 1960s into the 70s. And at the same time, you had an increase, a fairly sizable increase in government employment. The war on poverty and so on generated an awful lot of mid-level professional jobs to run the kinds of programs which you may have heard of, model cities and yep. Head Start and various other things. And so there was a preference for the kinds of people who lived in the communities that these programs were going to serve. So you had a big increase in professional employment for college-educated African-Americans and so on. And a lot of that went to women as well. And then the rug gets jerked out from under this as we go into the 1980s. Yes, and there are lots of reasons. And the rug starts to get gradually pulled without the big jerk yet of the career with one company and the financial security and the generally rising wages. And so on. And there are lots of ways to think about the causes of this. Some people say, you know, it was Ronald Reagan and his move to the right. And that certainly was true. The war on poverty was ended. So there was an end to that, to the growth and gradual mm-hmm. erosion of the professional jobs. And affirmative action was essentially ended in the late 70s, and then the door was slammed shut in the 1980s. And we started to get in the 70s, actually, the kinds of forces that eroded the manufacturing sector in the United States.
But the most important thing that you haven't touched on, because we only have a couple minutes left, is yeah. also the end of the union. So, to me seems to be almost the most crucial thing. You've got this rise in what is described in the articles as shareholder capitalism.
Yes, I do.
Stop making investment. And then you have unions who would be asking for money for wages and benefits and whatever, and they're getting busted. And as a result, it's, you know, you see the money going this way, but not to workers.
Yes, no, the two things. One is that the manufacturing sector, which was the union bastion, starts to shrink. And through plant closings and eventually a move overseas, and also that the legislative bedrock of union support, allowing them to unionize,
organize,
and supporting the right to unionize starts to erode. But I do want to make one quick point,
okay,
just because I think it's something that people don't often understand, which is they say, well, it was technology and globalization, so all the jobs had to go overseas. I mean, you know, there's nothing we could do about it. What can we do about it? Well, there is some truth to the movement of jobs overseas through technological change, through the internationalization of the supply of work and so on like that. But the companies that moved the jobs overseas and so on made enormous profits through doing that, okay? So, and the question is, what happened to those profits? Those could have been reinvested into new kinds of products, new kinds of processes, new skills for workers, and so on. So there could have been a generation of new sorts of jobs that generate a decent living and a more secure living. But they didn't. They went to Wall Street. Many big companies, Exxon, Apple, Microsoft, and so on, spend almost all their profits going out to their shareholders, either in dividends or buying back their stock.
So, Philip, I got to let you go. Go on, Ken.
They put them in offshore bank accounts and didn't pay U.S. taxes.
That's absolutely correct. No, the tax evasion became very, very creative, and the effort to go catch them was greatly diminished.
Well, that's the Panama Papers, all those other things that sort of pointed this out. But let me just say something. So as I'm listening to you talking about them, sort of this shareholder capitalism, if I hear it one more time, but they don't really believe it. So I'm watching MSNBC or CNN, and they're talking about how Wall Street is still doing well, as you know, 50 million Americans have lost their job, that the billionaires are making more money in the last 4 months during this pandemic, as everybody is seeing their income's crater. Okay, so we know some people are doing well, the shareholders on Wall Street and the billionaires. Okay, so we know that they're doing well as the rest of us are dying, we can't get tested, and we have COVID. So right. As I'm looking at this, and we talk about the shareholder capitalism, but if I hear one more time that Wall Street isn't the economy, they keep telling me that Wall Street isn't the economy. Well, if they really mean that, then they would demand that Wall Street invest in the frickin' economy. Because if it's not the economy, and they've got all this money, and the money is coming from somewhere, not from air, and since they basically call the U.S. home, and they basically have their children educated here, and they drive their Maseratis here, then if it's not the economy, then they have an obligation to invest in the economy.
Yeah,
and the fact that they haven't done that is what makes me absolutely nauseous. And if I hear one more time, but they're not the economy, then my question is, how come we can't tap their wealth?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. I mean, one is there's this myth that Wall Street is the fount of money for new investment and for new companies and so on. That's not true, is to say that by and large, companies have grown through retained earnings or loans and so on, but not from Wall Street. Wall Street is trading shares that are already out there.
Exactly.
And for many years, there's been more money going into Wall Street than coming out towards company development or investment.
And on this note, Philip, I'm going to have to let you go. There are the two articles.
I'm sorry, I'm just getting juiced up.
I know you are.
We're having fun here. Yeah.
I thought it was going to trickle down to all of us.
Oh, yeah, all that wealth's going to trickle down.
I think the thing that I will leave you with is that we need financial reform in the package.
Yes,
as well
absolutely.
As investment in infrastructure and education.
Exactly.
And so on. But until you put some restrictions on share buybacks and CEO pay and various other sorts of things, you are not going to neutralize the incentives to take money out of potential investment and send it up to the very, very rich.
Oh, God. Now the question is, if we get a new president, does Joe Biden have the capacity to do this? Or as the Democratic Party has sort of sold out to Wall Street and finance, and with the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the deregulation of derivatives, well, and the fact that no one did a
perp walk. Depends on who he listens to. If he listens to Elizabeth Warren about, she knows financial regulation. Yes. She knows she's the most knowledgeable about finance and what around. Or whether he listens to some of the old Obama advisors who really did come from Wall Street.
Oh,
that's,
God,
that's
Philip,
the question.
All right, Philip Moss. Yes, he's now a professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. His piece, "There Could Be No Equality Without a Dramatic Renewal of Employment Opportunity for All American Workers." Yes, his area of expertise is looking at the African-American experience, but guess what? They were the last in. But if there's no place to get in, it's not just going to hurt them, it's going to hurt all
working,
of us.
The white working class followed suit, and they have had the same experience, only they didn't have as far to fall.
Thank you so much, Philip Moss.
It's been a pleasure.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Stick around. We're talking about McCarthy next. A book called Demagogue.
Right.
We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day some of the worst violence of the Great Railroad Strike erupted in Pittsburgh. The strike started days earlier. It's contested as to whether it began in Martinsburg, West Virginia, or Baltimore, Maryland. The strike spread rapidly along the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad to New York State, Pennsylvania, and throughout the Midwest. At its height, the Great Railroad Strike involved well over 100,000 workers. The strike began on the Pennsylvania Railroad on the 19th. Management repeatedly tried to move trains through the yards and was confronted by angry strikers. Pennsylvania guardsmen were called out. The strikers presented the railroad with their demands. They wanted an end to double-engine trains that required fewer workers, wages reinstated, reinstatement for their fired co-workers, and an end to pay grades. Local militia sided with the strikers and refused to show for duty. When thousands of strikers gathered at the depot, the Pennsylvania National Guard moved unsuccessfully to disperse them. Then they fired on the strikers, killing 20 and wounding 29. The strikers were infuriated by the deadly aggression and drove guardsmen into a nearby railroad roundhouse. Word spread quickly throughout the city of the massacre, launching a virtual general strike. Workers began seizing arms wherever they could find them. They set fires to dozens of railroad buildings, burned down the Union Depot, destroyed over 100 locomotives, and more than 1,000 freight and passenger cars. The next day, guardsmen shot their way out of the roundhouse, killing 20 more as they were chased from the city. A total of 3,000 federal troops would be necessary to quell strikers' fury by month's end. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
À nos enfants de la patrie, le jour de gloire est arrivé. Contre nous de la tyrannie, l'étendard sanglant est levé. L'étendard sanglant est levé.
Entendez-vous
dans nos campagnes
rugir ces féroces soldats.
Ils viennent jusque dans vos bras, égorger vos fils et vos compagnes. Aux armes citoyens, formez vos bataillons.
Marchons,
qu'un sang impur abreuve nos sillons. Aux armes citoyens, formez vos bataillons.
Marchons,
qu'un sang impur abreuve.
Welcome to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I'm trying to figure out what the first book was that I actually got to sort of share with Larry Tye, my next guest, who is a prolific biographer. He's written books like Satchel, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, The Father of Spin, Edward L. Bernays and the Birth of Public Relations, Rising from the Rails, the book I talked about yesterday, about the Pullman Porters, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. But the book we're going to be talking about today, my God, this man must be prescient, Larry Tye, is entitled Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. So Larry, I just have to say something. I think you have more chutzpah than anybody I know. And the reason I say that is there have been 150 books written about Joe McCarthy. So you need to be 151? I'm just trying to figure this out. Except we both know something that most people don't know, is that you had access to so much more material that you would write a book nobody would ever have read before. Welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be back with you, and I love the way you phrase that, and I think you're being polite. I mean, the real reason is, why the heck should we read book number 151 on Joe McCarthy? And the answer is, if I could take just a minute and tell you the new material that was out there.
Please do that. That's what makes it so exciting, because when I heard that, I was like, oh my God, every page is a nugget of new information.
So the answer is, before I started on the book, there had been released 9,000 pages of transcripts on the closed door hearings that McCarthy held. And these are materials that looked at what Joe McCarthy unhinged was like. When he got behind closed doors, kicked out the public, kicked out the press, the question was what was he doing? And the answer is, we didn't know for more than 50 years. And before I started writing the book, this material was released, but there was so much of it that the press did what the press always does, which is they write a next day story, but nobody has time to read through 9,000 pages. Right. And the official historian of the US Senate, who was an old friend, was telling me there was an extraordinary trove of materials there. And this looked at what Joe McCarthy was like when he stopped even pretending to care about the rights of the accused. When he didn't do what the Senate in its long tradition always did, which is had at least two senators there conducting the hearings, and McCarthy loved being the only senator that was there. And when McCarthy wasn't there trampling on the rights of the accused, he turned to young sophomoric staffers, people we got to know later like Roy Cohn, and he let them do the abusing in his behalf. So what they also did, there was one last thing that I was fascinated by, which is when you read through these transcripts, they showed that in the morning, Joe McCarthy was relatively reasonable. But after a lunch of his traditional favorites, a hamburger, a raw onion, and plenty of whiskey to wash it all down, he became even more unpredictable in the afternoon. He stopped again pretending to be polite, and he just got increasingly unhinged. So there was that as one trove of material. The second big stash, which I had given up on having any chance to get a look at, was the personal and professional papers that his widow left 60 years ago to his alma mater, Marquette University. And that was everything from his diaries that he kept in real time when he was on a South Pacific island during World War II, to his love letters, to all the materials showing who was really underwriting his right-wing crusade. Mm-hmm. That was a second stash. The last group of papers, which I had even less chance of getting, I thought, was his military records and his medical files, all the papers showing what McCarthy was suffering from and what he died from, kept by Bethesda Naval Hospital, released only at the last minute. It showed up one day in a huge box at the head of my driveway. And if I couldn't write a good book with all those materials, then shame on me. I'm too close to know whether I did. But I had access to things that biographers had been hoping for 60 years and never gotten.
But what is so crucial about this is that, so he's such a complicated figure. And most of the material that you had access to gave him a level of dimension that is so important. And you also, I was looking at one of your YouTube videos, and you said that you were approached about writing a book about Barack Obama. And I applaud you for not doing it, because it's too soon. You're absolutely right. We need time to digest and step away and take a look at ultimately what is his legacy. But the idea of picking up Demagogue, the life and long shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy, the timing of this with the election of Donald Trump is frightening and prescient. And Larry, as I'm looking at this book, I had read a very sort of short book called On Tyranny by Tim Snyder from Yale University. And Tim, in 2016, was realizing that this man, Donald Trump, could win, and he knew what it would mean. And he understood that he would basically bully people and manipulate the media, and that he could lead to authoritarianism. So he wrote this book. And I almost think that Larry Tai and Tim Snyder need to be on the same stage someday together. And you need to talk, because the timing of both his book and your book gives us a real handle on what the hell is happening now.
So there is not a day that went by when I was doing my research that I didn't get confused whether I was reading headlines from 70 years ago or today's headlines. There is not a day since the book came out that I have not listened to NPR giving us the evening headlines or the New York Times the next morning and thought, geez, I've got to write another op-ed, because Donald Trump got that directly from Joe McCarthy. Now, every author who comes out with a book these days says they are the one that will explain who Donald Trump really is. But in my case, I had a flesh and blood through line. It was not speculation. It was one guy's protege, meaning McCarthy's Roy Cohn, being another guy's tutor, meaning an aged Roy Cohn tutoring and being the mentor for Donald Trump when he was first getting involved with the real estate business. He told Donald Trump how to behave in the public forum. His lessons were not Roy Cohn's lessons, they were Joe McCarthy's lessons. And the playbook is so clear that it is, to me, the way to understand why and how and what will be coming from Donald Trump the next day.
It is shocking. And it was interesting, because as I was reading your book, one of the things that you said is your idea that he became an ism, McCarthyism, that this is, I'm not sure it's a tribute, but that's what he became. And as I'm putting this together, I put on Facebook the following. People may not remember Senator Joe McCarthy. Joe spent 5 years trying to expose communists and gays in the U.S. government. But the term McCarthyism is part of our political lexicon, a campaign or practice that endorses the use of unfair allegations and investigations. And then I wrote, people may never forget President Trump. But curious, how will we define Trumpism? In a way, I feel like this is the extension of your book. It drives people to start asking those questions and to understand. You mentioned Roy Cohn. So here's what I got to figure out. So Roy is hired when he's only 25 years old. He's like a baby. Who taught who? Did Joe teach Roy, or did Roy kind of sort of help to sort of enhance what Joe McCarthy was able to do?
A great question. And the answer is that Roy Cohn was callow when he came to work in 1953 for this new powerful chairman who was part of this new Republican majority swept in with Eisenhower. Roy Cohn was hired by Joe McCarthy because Cohn had a track record in actually prosecuting and convicting communists, which is something they used to say about Joe McCarthy, that he could be dropped in the middle of Red Square on May Day and he wouldn't recognize a communist. The people he was pointing fingers at were not the 24-carat spies that he dreamed of finding. They were either nothing to do with being a spy or even a communist at all, or they were minor figures, union officials or others, who had a leftist bent, but who sure as heck weren't what Joe McCarthy was looking for. So McCarthy thought that Roy Cohn could help him find his defining figure, his Julius Rosenberg, his Alger Hiss.
He never did.
He never did. And in fact, Roy Cohn had no real clue, and I'm not sure any real interest in doing that. He had an interest in having fun. He had an interest in Bobby Kennedy, as Bobby Kennedy said, in taking McCarthy up the mountain in a toboggan and having him go down with no brakes. And Roy Cohn was clearly the assistant. It was Joe McCarthy who was in charge. Roy Cohn was very smart. He was very arrogant and he was very irresponsible, which meant that he reinforced every bad instinct that Joe McCarthy started with.
Ken.
I was just going to ask you how Bobby Kennedy was involved, what his role was, because he was counsel for the committee as well, right? The House on America.
He was. So that's a very good question. And the answer is Bobby Kennedy had just graduated from law school. Papa Joe Kennedy had given enough money to Joe McCarthy that when Joe Kennedy called Joe McCarthy and said, hire my son, Joe McCarthy said, absolutely. And it was until the end a mystery to Joe McCarthy and to anybody else paying attention, who would become the guy in charge of the staff. Now we have to wonder, what if Joe McCarthy had put Bobby Kennedy instead of Roy Cohn in charge? Would Joe McCarthy have been different? Would Bobby Kennedy have been different? Would American history have been different? That is fun to speculate. We don't know. What we do know is that Roy Cohn was in charge. Roy Cohn hated Bobby Kennedy, and Bobby Kennedy hated Roy Cohn. And so after 5.5 months, Bobby Kennedy took off, and Roy Cohn had the committee truly to himself at that point. And what we also know is that it was Roy Cohn and his sidekick, a guy named David Shine, who truly took down Joe McCarthy. They took on the U.S. Army. They took on the cause of getting special treatment for David Shine. And it was an enemy too big for Joe McCarthy to bully. And that was, as we know, the Army and McCarthy hearings were brought on.
Right.
Joe McCarthy went from, at the beginning of 1954, when those
an
hearings
incredible
started.
Story. Yeah, keep going.
Joe McCarthy was at 50% popularity. George Gallup told us that one in every two Americans thought Joe McCarthy was doing a brilliant job. That put him behind just one person in those days, Dwight Eisenhower, the second most popular public figure in America. That was at the beginning of the hearings. After he tried to bully, and after the country watched him try to bully the U.S. Army, by the end of those hearings, his numbers had plummeted from 50% to 34%. By the end of that year, the Senate, seeing those numbers plummet, the Senate finally had the courage to take on and censure Joe McCarthy. But the real point of the story, the point of his taking on the Army and what happened to him in 1954, is that my book on Joe McCarthy is a good news story. The story is, give a bully enough rope and they will hang themselves. I think the story is not only prescient for what's going on today, because the bully has been given a lot of rope, but I think Donald Trump, the one enemy that Donald Trump has taken on that looks like it is too big to bully,
military.
Is the military.
Exactly. I was reading it, I'm screaming, going, oh my God. And they follow the same template, Larry.
They
go after the Department of State, all these sort of soft targets, and then they go after the military. And you and I both know, as you write in your book, initially, you know, Eisenhower and the military kind of played with him. They kind of worked with him. They didn't push back, but he kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And eventually they realized they had to stand up to him. And they were the only ones that could actually do it.
They did. And finally, Eisenhower, who had no courage and no backbone during the first year plus of his administration when it came to Joe McCarthy, Eisenhower's brother, Milton, from day one of Eisenhower assuming the presidency, was whispering in Dwight's ear, saying, give up a tiny bit of your popularity and take on the bully. And Eisenhower said, no, we'll wait. Well, waiting may have looked smart if you were a general trying to marshal your troops, but if people's lives were being destroyed the way they were by Joe McCarthy, that was not courage, that was cowardice. And it wasn't until his sacred U.S. Army was taken on that finally Eisenhower developed the backbone. And I think historians have given Eisenhower a free pass that he didn't deserve. And Eisenhower is like Mitch McConnell, is like all the Republicans in the Senate who are giving Donald Trump a free pass. And I think that someday history will judge them, and it won't be kindly. The one Republican senator in the early days who stood up and confronted Joe McCarthy today is known for that more than anything she is known for, and exactly. That is your neighbor and her my name. Neighbor, Margaret Chase Smith. Yeah. And I think that she didn't do a whole lot else in her Senate career that was exceptional, but we remember her today for her famous Declaration of Conscience. Joe McCarthy dubbed Margaret Chase Smith and her six Republican co-signatories Snow White and the six dwarfs. But today history looks very differently, and I think that as we get closer to the election, if Donald Trump's numbers continue to be as anemic as they are today, we will see fellow Republicans develop some sort of backbone. Not that I'm going to hold my breath for that, but there is a lesson in this Joe McCarthy history, and it is you have to stand up or you will be judged.
Larry, it is what you just said. It is so amazing. Every page, you could take the name Joe McCarthy out and put in Donald Trump. It is just, it's shocking. It's shocking, but it sort of says that these the bullies have the same template. You know what I mean? They work the same thing. They lie, and then when they're caught in a lie, they give you another lie. When they get told that they're wrong, then they blame the media for telling them wrong, so you can't trust the media. I mean, it's like everything he did is exactly what Donald Trump is doing. I mean, it's unbelievable that you don't see almost a variation on a theme. You see a parallel track, which is what's so crazy. But I just want to ask one point. You said that we have this sort of love affair, this infatuation with bullies. And I think what's interesting to me is, you know why we may at least think we like bullies? We want someone to take care of us. We want someone to take the burden of choice. And I don't have to, you tell me who to blame, I'll blame them. You tell me I don't have to worry about this. And in a way, what a bully does is kind of like what Joe McCarthy did was, I'll protect you from the communists. I'll protect you from the gays. So in a lot of ways, it was the idea that you didn't have to think, I would do the thinking for you. And then you find out that they're not doing the thinking for you. They're undermining your stability. They're undermining your security. They're actually doing the opposite. They're hurting you.
So you, as always, say it more eloquently than I can, but I think that what is true is that the fears in the 1950s and the fears in 2016 were real. In 1950, it was the fear of the Soviet Union and of potential spies. In 2016, it was the fear of economic security. The problem is that in lieu of real solutions, all they do is point fingers. And McCarthy pointed a finger at non-existent communists in the State Department and in the White House and elsewhere, just like Donald Trump is telling us that we will deal with our economic security if only we keep those evil refugees from crossing the border and we put up a border wall. And every time one of their solutions is proven to be hollow, they just lob a fresh bombshell.
Exactly.
And who I point a finger at myself is my profession, my lifelong profession of journalism, because we act as a megaphone. If we didn't pay attention to what they said, or we call them out from the beginning as liars, then they wouldn't get away with it. But they repeat their same solutions so mind-numbingly often that I wonder with Trump, and I definitely wondered with McCarthy, in the end, whether he actually believed the things that he knew at the beginning were frauds. I think in the end, after he had lost all of his public support and after he had lost all of his colleagues' support, in the end, one of the only people who believed what Joe McCarthy was saying was Joe McCarthy. And that partly was because alcohol had gotten to him. And we know from his medical records that he had always had a drinking problem. And by the end, he was a scary alcoholic. And that is what the records tell us killed him. Even though the official cause of death in the coroner's report was acute hepatitis, the records make clear that he drank himself to death. And the records also make clear that he died a sad and tragic figure. And who knows what will happen today with our current demagogue in chief.
Let me just ask a quick question, because I only have a few minutes left. And so, Larry, as I'm thinking about this, but we know in the era of social media, we are now in the era of the billionaire. I mean, we were just talking to a guy about the fact that, you know, just in the last couple of months, the billionaires have gotten richer. We've actually created more billionaires, even as 50 million people have lost their jobs. Millions more have lost their health insurance. And I am just wondering that even though the words and the approach and who to blame and the liar, all the things are identical with Donald Trump and with McCarthy, my fear is that we have sort of a added value in 2020. And the added value isn't necessarily added value for me. It's added value for Trump. And as you pointed the finger of blame at journalism, remember, they created Donald Trump. They gave him billions of dollars of free media because he was a ratings god. They weren't challenging him. They gave him an opportunity to do things no candidate in history had the ability to do. So from his creation to become president of the United States, and now as you're pointing out to the media today, do you really think that your book and what happened to Joe could be really happening to Donald?
Yes, in terms of the decline, I think it is that Joe McCarthy was dramatically more popular than Donald Trump has ever been for a day of his presidency. That 50% rating is something Trump hasn't approached. Right. And I have faith only because I have no choice. And I know you have faith and you're an optimist and Ken's an optimist. We all have to hope that what we saw happen to McCarthy and every other demagogue in our history will happen again, because I think America, while it buys into simplistic answers, once it discovers or rediscovers its better nature, always buys out of it as well.
Ken.
You were talking earlier about how people didn't stand up to McCarthy or Trump because everybody wants someone to take care of them. It's hard to imagine a bully like Trump or McCarthy as being someone that any normal person would feel is going to take care of us. So I think it's almost the opposite sentiment. It's fear. I'm afraid the guy's going to beat the living daylights out of me. And all it takes really is for someone to have the courage to stand up and say the emperor has no clothes, or this is wrong. I know the difference between right and wrong, and this is wrong. And hopefully people will follow. You're right. I'm optimistic, Larry. But I think it's more fear of being beaten to a pulp. And I think that's obviously what the Republicans are thinking with respect to Trump. Anybody that dares to say anything in opposition to him is going to get clobbered.
So I agree with you. I think that what it takes, though, in terms of the person who's going to stand up to them is somebody who is beyond fear, either because they're so popular or they've got nothing else they've got to prove.
Lose.
And
yeah.
I think that was Dwight Eisenhower, and he could have done it earlier in that day. I think it is a fellow Mainer. We don't have Margaret Chase Smith around anymore to do it, but and this may be way out there and have no chance of happening, but I think one of the few people who has really nothing to lose today is George Bush. I think that he's been pushed so hard and
yes.
he watched his
yes.
brother destroyed
yes.
by Donald
yes.
Trump. Watch what happens between now and the election. He may be the one Republican who really has the stature and the gumption and the reason in terms of his own personal revenge to stand up and say something, and we'll see.
And you're also seeing the Lincoln Project, Larry. I mean, the Lincoln Project is doing things that are lethal. You know, Democrats may think this, but they won't put it in an ad. These guys know it. They know how to do it. They refine the art, and they got the stiletto out. It's just,
true. And
it's
imagine if the Lincoln Project had George Bush to feature in one of their ads. And the,
so
who knows, but the, we'll see what happens. All we can say is that history teaches us to know better, and hopefully we will.
Larry Tighe.
I'm really optimistic, Larry. Thank you.
Larry Tighe, the author of Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. This book is riveting. You're going to read it and you're going, you sure this isn't about Donald? And you're going to go, it's not. But that's why in some ways it's kind of an interesting Bible, Larry. It's something we need to read in order to understand our present. Thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you for being so diligent in finding these materials and going through 9,000 pages of hearings. I can't believe it. But join me anytime you write anything, Mr.
So it's worth writing a book just to be able to come back on with you, and I look forward to the next one. Thank you.
I love you, Mr. Tighe. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Stick around for tomorrow.